Genesis 33-34, the 33rd talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on November 17, 2002, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Day, but I don't see a good way around it. We're going to be looking at the last part of chapter 33 of Genesis, and then we're going to do chapter 34. If you'll remember back to last week, Jacob is headed towards Canaan. He knows that Esau is coming to meet him, and that causes a great deal of anxiety on the part of Jacob. So Jacob does three things. One, he divides his company into two so that if Esau attacks one, that perhaps the other one will be able to get away. Then he prays to God for help in this situation. And then thirdly, he sends out this huge gift in installments. And it's a gift of livestock. He sends a small flock as a gift to Esau, followed by another small flock, by another small flock. And Esau's going to get those one after the other. This is all an attempt to gain favor with Esau, to communicate to Esau that Jacob is coming on terms of peace. He wants to reconcile himself after having stolen both the birthright and the blessing from Esau much earlier. And God has shown his protection of Jacob in a couple of different ways. First, angels appeared, and Jacob saw the angels, and those angels gave him a certain amount of reassurance, just their appearance. Then, in the night just before the action that we're going to read today, Jacob, having started the night very restlessly and with a lot of activity and still is clearly experiencing a great deal of anxiety, he ends up wrestling with God. He wrestles with this man. He doesn't know who it is. And the wrestling match ends up taking the whole night. And in the end, Jacob comes to understand that he is wrestling with God himself. And Jacob won't let God go until God has blessed him, even though God touches him on the hip and dislocates his hip, and he's in a great deal of pain. Jacob keeps wrestling until God blesses him. And God blesses him, changes his name from Jacob to Israel. So from the heel grabber to the one who struggled with God. So now the wrestling match is over. Morning has come. And Jacob is still limping from pain from the dislocated hip. And he's in a certain amount of anxiety still. But we'll see from his actions that he's kind of changed his perspective from what it was the day before. However, he seems to think that the worst could still happen. So we'll pick up at, let me see. Oh, pick up the beginning of chapter 33. We'll read the almost the whole chapter. Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. And he put the two maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and he saw the women and the children and said, "Who are these with you?" So he said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." Then the maids came near with their children and they bowed down. And Leah likewise came near with her children and they bowed down. And afterward, Joseph came near with Rachel and they bowed down. And he said, "What do you mean by all this company which I have met?" And he said, "To find favor in the sight of my Lord." But Esau said, "I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own." And Jacob said, "No, please, if I now have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand. For I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." Thus he urged him, and he took it. Then Esau said, "Let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you." But he said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are frail, and that the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me. And if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure, according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir." And Esau said, "Please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Succoth, and built for himself a house, and made booths for him for his livestock. Therefore the place is named Succoth. Okay, Jacob looks up then. This is morning. He looks up, and he sees this cloud of dust, and Esau and his 400 men, his small army, are approaching. And remember that he had heard word that Esau was coming with 400 men, and that caused Jacob a great deal of anxiety. Well, now in the morning, he sees the cloud coming. He is no longer just hearing word of it. He's actually seeing them, and it has to cause a certain amount of apprehension on his part. So he divides up his children among his wives. Now, earlier, he had divided his company because his thinking was, if Esau attacks one, at least the other company has a chance of getting away. I assume that that would mean that he would divide up his sons and his wives as well between the two companies so that he would have descendants that would escape. But I don't know that for sure. It doesn't make that clear. In any case, at this point in time, he has brought all of his descendants together. All of his sons, all of his children, and all of his wives have been brought together. They're in one group. But he separates them according to which wife these children belong to. And he puts the wives of the maids in front, the children of the maids in front, then the children of Leah next, and then in the end, we've got Rachel and Joseph in the place of honor. This is interesting because now he's no longer setting them apart to protect them. So apparently he now has reason to think, he's beginning to believe, that Esau is not going to wipe them out. And furthermore, in the night before, he had been in the very back. Now we have Jacob going out in front. So Jacob's going to meet Esau first, then his wives and his children are going to be right behind him. And they are in a position that at this point is vulnerable. So he seems to have decided, he seems to be more confident that Esau is not going to destroy them. Jacob approaches Esau in a very dramatic fashion. He bows down 7 times. So he's being very, very respectful towards Esau. Esau, on the other hand, comes running to Jacob. And Esau greets him and kisses him. They embrace. And by the way, the word for embrace and the word for wrestle that was used in the previous chapter sound very similar. So there's a sense in which we have a repetition of a wrestling match. Esau embraces him, and he kisses him. And the kiss seems to be a sign of forgiveness. So Esau is coming in a very forgiving spirit and is very glad to see Jacob. And they both weep. And it's hard to put your finger on the emotions that are causing them to weep. They're weeping for different reasons. But it's hard to put your finger on exactly what emotions are causing the weeping. And I suppose there isn't one emotion. It's probably a flood of emotions. But for Jacob, it's the guilt that he has had and the apprehension that he's been experiencing. For Esau, it's probably the sense of resolution of he loves his brother, and now he has a chance to reconcile with him and express his sense of forgiveness that he has reached. In any case, it's a very joyous occasion. Then Esau looks, he looks at what's behind Jacob, and here they are, all the children. Now when Jacob left, Jacob was not married, and Jacob had no children. And now he's coming back, he's got four wives, and he's got 12 sons, and at least one daughter. So Esau asks, who are these? And Jacob says, this is my family, God has been gracious to me. Now he doesn't go into details. Jacob's really short on details here. He doesn't want to go into all the details, I think, and raise the memories of why it was that he left in the first place. Nor does he want to go through explaining how he got so many wives. All of that would be a little embarrassing, I suspect. Then Esau says, what about the company that you sent? And what that means in context, what it has to mean are these herds that were sent in increments. What's going on there? And Jacob says, it's a gift. It's a gift to you. In order to gain your favor. That's interesting because Jacob has not been known for his honesty throughout his life. And here we've got an instance where he's being very straightforward. What is the gift for? It's to gain your favor. Esau says, but I don't need it. Thanks, but no thanks. God has blessed me, which is interesting. Esau, too, has been blessed by God. And Esau is not lacking in flocks. He has plenty, he has a lot of, he has large flocks. He doesn't need the gift. But Jacob insists, no, please take it. And he changes the name. Before he had referred to them as his offering to Esau. When he had organized them and sent them out, the term that he had used to refer to them was his offering. And now he changes and uses a different word. He says, a blessing. And I think he's indicating here that this is, in a sense, restitution. Just as he had stolen the blessing from Esau, now he wants to bestow a blessing on Esau in restitution. So I think that Jacob sees it as important that Esau take this because that's the only way that he can feel reconciled. He has to make amends in a tangible way, and this gift is a tangible way of making amends. Throughout this discussion, it is interesting that Esau refers to Jacob as my brother. But Jacob refers to Esau as my Lord. Jacob's conscience is weighing heavily on him, and it's difficult for him to feel reconciled. Whereas for Esau, he's worked this out. It's not a problem anymore. So Jacob insists, and he says, I see your face as one sees the face of God. It's a little difficult to know exactly what he means by that. But It must be a reference to the night before when he had wrestled with God. And at that time he had said, I have seen the face of God, yet live. So he has reconciled with God, and God has looked upon him with favor. And now the same thing is happening with Esau. He has reconciled himself with Esau, and Esau is looking upon him with favor. So Esau takes the gift, and I think that Esau is taking the gift partially out of recognition that it is important for Jacob that he take the gift. Because only by taking the gift can he indicate his acceptance of Jacob and Jacob's tacit request for forgiveness. Okay. Now this next section is interesting. This first section, you can sense that there is true reconciliation happening at a certain level. And there's great relief. It's a great burden off of Jacob's mind in particular to have this face-to-face encounter with his brother and to have all of his guilt dealt with. But now they start negotiating about the continuation of this trip. And here you can see that things are not entirely resolved between them. Esau offers to accompany Jacob the rest of the way. And as you read on in the account, what he means by the rest of the way is all the way on to Seir, which is where Esau is staking his claim, where he's carving out a territory for himself. And I wonder if this is not the reason why Esau came with an army of 400. He came with this army to provide an escort to Jacob and his company to their destination. Well, Jacob says, well, thanks, but no thanks. Your men, you could move a lot faster. We aren't capable of moving that fast. I've got flocks. I've got children. We have to move slowly. So you go on ahead. And Esau's response to that is, well, okay, but at least let me send a few men with you for protection. And Jacob says, oh, there's no need. Don't bother. We're fine. So he sends Esau on ahead, and Jacob and his company will travel on their own. So Esau goes on to Seir, apparently assuming that Jacob is going to follow on to Seir in his own time. But what the narrative goes on to say is he went from Jabbok, where he had wrestled with God. He goes from that creek about 2 miles north, that's the wrong way, to Succoth, and he there builds a house and builds shelters for his livestock. And it's called named Succoth for the shelters. So it becomes clear then that Jacob had no intention of going to Seir. Esau had assumed, of course, Jacob's going to come down and visit me and spend some time with me. And that's why he was going to accompany him down there or leave men to come down with him. Jacob says no to all of that. Why? Because Jacob has no intention of going down to Seir. He goes north, and then he's going to go into Canaan. So we see Jacob is not really at peace entirely with Esau. He's still bothered by his conscience. He doesn't feel fully reconciled. And on the one hand, but on the other hand, he can't come right out and explain to Esau, no, I'm not going to Seir. He just avoids the question and then doesn't go. This account of Esau is interesting because Esau, I think, turns out to be a rather impressive fellow when all is said and done. The Greeks used to say that you don't know whether a person has lived a happy life until they die. Because it isn't until they die that all the votes are in, that you can really assess the whole life. And who knows what might happen in the last few years. Well, there's a sense in which I think that's true from the biblical perspective as well. Because the critical issue in life is, does a person come to a place of making their peace with God? And that can happen at the very end of one's life. And that makes a world of difference when you're assessing their life. Did they live a good life or not? That is the critical question. Did they make their peace with God? And in Esau's situation, he began his life in a way that was rather unpromising. He did not value the promises of God. He didn't value what God had done with respect to his ancestors and cherish that and want it for himself. And he married the Canaanite women. He shows there that he didn't value the things that his family had valued. So his beginning was not promising. But in the 20 years that Jacob was gone, it appears as though Esau began to do some soul searching. If you recall back just before Jacob left, he discovered that his parents didn't like the fact that he, Esau, had married Canaanite women. So he found another wife who was a daughter of Ishmael. So you see right there a beginning of a change in values, at least potentially a change in values there. But over the period of 20 years, clearly Esau has come to terms with the injustice that was done to him by Jacob. And Jacob did do an injustice to him. But Esau has come to terms with that and has been able to, by all appearances, fully forgive Jacob. And that's a remarkable thing because he was done a great injustice. When I think of this sort of thing, I have this image in my mind. I will describe it to you, and hopefully it will be helpful. When I think of people and how they live their lives, I think of a graceful dancer. Actually, I'm going to use two different images, one dancing and one boxing. I know nothing about either, so take that into account. But a graceful dancer, I mean, even though I know nothing about dancing, there is something enjoyable about watching someone who dances well. That there is an effortlessness to it. There's a grace to it. There's something truly beautiful about someone who has that kind of control over their body. And it seems to me that there are some people who can live life gracefully. That is, there's a certain effortlessness about it. There's a certain grace to it. There's a certain control that is visible and that is admirable. Now, by this, I don't mean that it's someone who lives life without mistakes, but rather it's someone who understands what is the nature of life and can put things into perspective such that no matter what is thrown at them, they know how to deal with it. They know how to look at that, at what has been thrown at them, and put it into perspective. So it's kind of like, now I'll use a different picture, a boxer. Similarly, there are boxers who don't know what they're doing, and they just flail. It's all action and no effectiveness. But there are other people that understand how boxing works and are able to throw punches at the right time, in the right way, in the right place. And it's that kind of perspective on things, of knowing where to throw the punches, that makes the difference between an artless boxer and an artful boxer. I think similarly, life can be lived artfully or gracefully, or it can be lived artlessly and gracelessly. And Esau is showing a certain amount of gracefulness in the way that he's living his life. At the end of his life, he's learned this gracefulness in a 20-year period of time. And interestingly, God has blessed him. The thing that the injustice that was done to him was the loss of the blessing and the loss of the inheritance. And those are gone. That's true. But God has found another way to bless him and has indeed blessed him. So Esau has reached the place where the past no longer haunts him. But interestingly, there's a sense in which the past continues to haunt Jacob. Okay, let's look at the next section. This next little part at the end of chapter 33 is just kind of a transition into chapter 34. It says, "Now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram, and he camped before the city. And he bought the piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected there an altar and called it El Elohe Israel." So Jacob moves from Succoth into Shechem. So he's just going, if you were to look at a map in the back of your Bible or wherever, he's just moving across the Jordan into Canaan. He hasn't gone very far. He's just moved a little ways into Canaan. He reaches there safely. And there he decides to settle. He camps there first, and then he buys a piece of land. This is only the second time that we have mention of one of the patriarchs buying land in Canaan. And he buys land here. So he's setting down his roots here for a bit. If you work it out chronologically, apparently about 10 years has passed since he settles, from the time that he greets Esau to now, when the events happen in chapter 34. So apparently he settles in Shechem for quite a while before the events of chapter 34 take place. In verse 18, it's a little bit ominous. This is all a little bit like Lot. If we recall back to the story of Lot, Lot chose the well-watered land down below and left for Abraham the dry land up in the highlands when they had to divide. And he chose the land down below. He settled in the plain below near Sodom. And it says at that time, in the narrative, it says, "And the Canaanite was then in the land." And that's a very ominous sounding statement at that time, because only later we discover the significance of that, and that was Sodom was a very wicked place. Well, here we have Jacob moving into Canaan, and he settles near Shechem. And I think Canaan, again, is supposed to have an ominous sound to it. There's a sense in which this is probably not a wise choice. He has settled here near Shechem in Canaan, and he sinks his roots down right next to this city. The land that he buys from the sons of Hamor. And that's just introducing a name that becomes significant in the action that follows. He pays 100 pieces of money. We don't know if that's a high price or a low price because it's a denomination of money that we don't know of elsewhere. But he clearly, he has legal claim to this land. And interestingly, this land was still known in the time of Jesus. In John chapter 4, when he meets the woman by the well, that well is on this piece of property that Jacob purchased at this time. So Jacob, if you will recall, had made a promise before he left at Bethel, before he left the land of Palestine. He had made a promise to God. After God had promised to him that God would take care of him, Jacob promised that if I return safely, then I will make you my God. And so the narrative says here, he came safely to the city of Shechem. So in recognition of the fact that God has kept his promise, Jacob erects there an altar, and he calls it El Elohe Israel, God, the God of Israel. So he erects an altar to the God of to his God. In other words, proclaiming Yahweh to be his God, just as he had said that he would do. Now, chapter 34 is a disturbing chapter, and I suppose since Ron has rated some of his talks, I suppose I should rate this talk PG-13 as well. Let's read the first 17 verses. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. And he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. And he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young girl for a wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob kept silent until they came in. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it and acquire property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according as you say to me. But give me the girl in marriage." But Jacob's sons answered Shechem his father Hamor with deceit and spoke to them because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you, if you will become like us, in that every male of you be circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go." Okay, Dinah is probably about 15 or 16 years old at this point in time. We don't know how long they've lived here on the outskirts of Shechem, but presumably they didn't stay in Succoth all that long. After all, they built temporary buildings. So presumably after they had recovered their strength, the livestock had recovered and replenished itself, then they move into Shechem. So presumably they have been in Shechem for a number of years. They've certainly been in the land for about 10 years in this area in general. It says that Dinah went out to visit the daughters of the land. In that culture, it was apparently not proper for a single girl to be out alone. Now, it was not unheard of in Haran. If you will recall, Rachel was out herding the flocks and apparently was out on her own to some degree. But here in Canaan, that apparently is a no-no. That is culturally not proper for a girl to be out on her own. And it says that she visits the daughters of the land. Remember, it was the daughters of Canaan that Abraham and Isaac did not want their sons to be married to. So I think that we are to understand here that what Dinah has done is not wise. It may not be entirely wrong, but there's something slightly inappropriate about this. She's being a little bit inappropriate, a little bit seeming possibly even a little flirtatious. Shechem, who is a young man of high regard within his community, he sees her, and he takes her, and he rapes her. But after he rapes her, he says that he loved her, and he spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem has some genuine affection for Dinah, and he would like to marry her. He would like to have a permanent relationship with her. So Shechem goes to his father, and he says to his father Hamor, "Get me this young girl for a wife." This is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is the whole approach to his father is rather disrespectful. There's no form of address. He doesn't say, "Father, get me this girl." It's just, "Get me this girl." And the word that he used for girl is a term that is slightly disrespectful. Whereas the narrator has been referring to Dinah as a maiden, Shechem here uses a less respectful term. So if I could put this into the vernacular, it would be, "Get me that chick," or something like that. I mean, it's just, there's no please, there's no father, and it's get me this, get me that girl. So Shechem apparently is a spoiled child. He's one who's used to getting what he wants, and one who does not relate to his father respectfully. Now, Jacob has found out that this, what has happened. Jacob's whole response throughout this is one of the most puzzling things in the passage, because there's no indication of moral outrage on the part of Jacob. Jacob is amazingly silent and non-participatory in what happens in the action that follows. He has heard what's happened to his daughter. His sons at the time were out in the fields with the livestock, but Jacob decides to not send word out to them as to what has happened. He's going to wait until they return before he informs them of what has happened. Now, it's not clear why he's waiting. It may be that he's afraid of their response, that they might respond precipitously. Or it's just, I'm not sure. He doesn't know what to do. In any case, Hamor comes. Hamor complies with his son's wish. He comes and begins to talk to Jacob, opens the negotiations for a way that his son can marry Dinah. These negotiations have apparently just begun when the brothers arrive. They have found out anyway. Even though Jacob did not send word to them, they have found out, and they come in. Their response is much more pronounced than was Jacob's. It says that the men were grieved and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. Their response is unambiguous. What has happened is an absolute moral outrage. It should never have happened. And the terms that are used here are very strong terms. Their response, the words that are used here are similar to God's response to the people that lived at the time of Noah before the flood. That God was shocked in a way that the sons here are shocked at the behavior. So their response is very clear. They are outraged. But Hamor, he begins the negotiations now. And interestingly, Jacob is not a participant in these negotiations. It's the sons that take over. And this is curious in light of what happened when Isaac went to Haran initially and wanted to negotiate to marry. Wait just a second. When the servant went to Haran to try to negotiate the marriage between Rebekah and Isaac, and he ended up negotiating with Rebekah's brother, not Rebekah's father. So we have a similar thing happening here, that it's the brothers who enter into the negotiations with Hamor. But Jacob's silent. Jacob is not a participant in this, very curiously. The negotiations on the part of Hamor, his appeal is, he doesn't say that his son did something wrong. There's no indication that he thinks that his son has done anything wrong. It is all an appeal to the brothers that they allow their daughter to be married to his son. Why? Because of all of the advantages that would come to them. And what are the advantages that would come to them? They could marry the daughters of the inhabitants of Shechem. And beyond that, there are economic advantages. And he lists the economic advantages. One is that they could peacefully co-settle here in this land. So they could become a permanent part of this community. They could engage in trade. So there is economic benefit that would come to them. And thirdly, and this is the most valuable of the concessions that are being made, they could gain permission to acquire property. So just as Jacob bought that one piece of land, presumably he had to go through extra hoops in order to purchase that land because Jacob and his family do not have the right normally to buy land in this area. If you'll recall, Isaac had to get special permission to purchase a piece of land. So what he's saying is, you can have the right to buy land from anybody here, just like we can buy land from each other. So that's an important right that they would gain. He offers no apology, there's no restitution, and there's no admission of wrongdoing. Shechem then pipes in and tries to sweeten the pot by saying that he would also give wealth to the brothers. Now, apparently, according to the law of the ancient Near East, and presumably this is the law that we know about from Mesopotamia, presumably the law in Canaan is similar, and that is if someone rapes another woman and the father of the woman that was raped is willing to allow the rapist to marry him, then that is allowed if he pays an extra price and he has no right to divorce. But those are the two qualifications. Shechem, in offering this wealth, is apparently complying with that part of the law. Jacob's sons then respond. To deal with these problems that come along. And when it says that they answered with deceit, according to Bruce Waltke, every place in Genesis that you find this word deceit, it's used pejoratively. So this is a bad thing that they are doing. Here is the plan. They say, in order for us to intermarry, for your son to marry Dinah, and for us to enter into this community agreement, everyone in your community would have to be circumcised because that is our custom, that all of the males need to be circumcised. So before we can merge these communities, everyone, all the males in your community would have to be circumcised. This is interesting because it's not clear whether all of the brothers have got together on this or not. If some of them have not got together on this plan, then some of the brothers are acquiescing to a merging of communities in a way that their ancestors had resisted strenuously, merging their community with a Canaanite community. But it's not clear whether all of the brothers were in on the plot or not. It may be that all of them were in agreement that this was just a plot. There was no intention of merging communities. Hamor and Shechem, they say, fine, let's do it. And Shechem is the first one to get circumcised because he is so driven by his infatuation with Dinah that there's no question but what he wants this deal. And Shechem, because he wants this so badly and because he is so honored in his community, he is able to persuade the whole community to agree to these terms, which says a great deal about the community, that Shechem is the kind of person who is so highly honored. He appeals to the city council, that hoping that they will all agree to this proposal. In his address to the city council, what is interesting is, first of all, he never indicates what is the motivating force behind this proposal. The fact that he has raped Dinah and wants to marry her. It's only presented as this thing that would be good for the whole community. The other thing that's interesting about it is he presents it in a way that's not quite right. It's kind of slanted. He's putting it in terms that would be most attractive to the city council. There's no mention of the right of Jacob and his family to acquire property. So the right that was most valuable to Jacob and his family is omitted when he's talking to the city of Shechem, the people of Shechem. And he says, this would be a good thing because we will all end up acquiring the wealth that Jacob and his family have. Through trade and negotiations and stuff, we will end up appropriating that wealth for ourselves. So, expressed in those terms, the city council agrees to it. And it says that the people in the council are all those who go in and out of the gate. That is apparently a term that refers to every able-bodied man. Because those who go in and out of the gate are the ones who are willing to go out and fight for the defense of the city-state. So that seems to be a term for able-bodied men. So every able-bodied man, then, they are the ones who agree to the terms, and therefore they are all circumcised. And that becomes important in the next section. So 18 through 24. Now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. And the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke. Whoops. Have I not read this? This is the stuff that I just talked about. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, "These men are friendly with us. Therefore, let them live in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will live with us." And all who went out of the gate of the city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem. And every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. Now it came about on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male. And they killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field. And they captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" Okay. So, they have all circumcised themselves, and we're in the third day then, and they are not healed. So these men are in pain and incapacitated for going out to fight. And two of Jacob's sons, but they are both sons by Leah, and Dinah was Leah's daughter. So it's two of Leah's sons then take it upon themselves to go into Shechem and kill every man in Shechem. So they fall upon them with a sword and they take them unawares. They kill everyone. And they took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. Now this is something that has not been clear up to now, but apparently throughout the negotiations, Dinah was still being kept at Hamor's house or Shechem's house. So there's a sense in which Hamor and Shechem have an ace up their sleeve. They've got Dinah as a hostage back at home. So part of what Levi and Simeon are doing is they are killing all the men of Shechem, but they are also rescuing their sister. After they have slayed all of the men of Shechem, then the other sons of Jacob become involved, and they go through and loot and pillage the city and take all the wealth. So the proposal was, as it was stated by Hamor to the people of Shechem, is that you will get all of Jacob's possessions. But as it turns out, it's Jacob that gets the possessions of the people of, it's Jacob's family that gets the possessions of the people of Shechem. Then they come home, and Jacob is outraged. And his outrage is interesting, because it's not moral outrage. His concern is, now we are vulnerable. Now, everybody in the land is going to think that we are outlaws, and they're going to come after us and get us, and we don't have the manpower to be able to defend ourselves against all of the people of the land. So what you did was a stupid thing to do. And their response is, should he treat our sister as a harlot? Interestingly, he refers to Dinah as our sister and not your daughter. And Jacob has no response to it. This is a puzzling section. Jacob is not providing moral leadership here. I mean, it's there may be cultural reasons why various things are happening, but it's hard to ignore the fact that there's no indication that Jacob is supplying moral leadership here. He's just kind of stepping back and letting his sons do what they will. His sons, on the other hand, are expressing moral outrage. But they are expressing moral outrage and acting in a way that I think we are to understand is not wise. It is interesting. We don't have commentary right here on the actions of the brothers. But when Jacob is proclaiming his final deathbed blessing upon the sons, when it comes to Simeon and Levi, he curses their anger. And I think that we are to see that as a commentary on their action here. What they have done here is wrong. Their moral outrage was right, but they didn't respond to it wisely. They didn't take wise action. And in Jacob's lack of providing leadership, the sons are stepping in. And as the sons step in, they aren't acting wisely, and we see another thing happening, and that is these splits within the family are becoming significant, because it is Leah's brothers who come to the defense of Leah, and in response to the challenge from their father, why did you do what you did? Their response is, our sister, rather than your daughter. So this is setting the stage then for what the action that we're going to see in the next few chapters, and that is the growing significance of this rift that has developed within the family between the children of the different wives that Jacob has taken on. Okay, I have again run over time, but let's take a couple of questions at least.
We're going to beat you. Now, this is an impression, and it may be way off, but my impression of the patriarchs and moral leadership seems, in many instances, to kowtow to practicality. And again, this is one instance when Jacob isn't holding the moral card, and he's just going, you know, that was really stupid because we may not exist tomorrow.
Right.
And
Yes, I think that they have done that before. We've seen that. I think Abraham and Isaac both do that, especially with respect to the trick of saying that this my wife is my sister rather than saying this is my wife. So yes, I think this is not unparalleled.
Is the name of the town Shechem, or is that where Shechem lived?
The name of the town is Shechem, and that's where Shechem lived. It's not clear. The commentators say that it probably received the name Shechem later, and for what reasons is not clear. It was probably not named Shechem at this particular time.
So they're not saying that the father spoiled the son by naming the whole town.
The commentators don't think that's the case, and the commentators are never wrong. One more. Mark.
Oh. I'm intrigued at your statement about Jacob using the word blessing to refer to what he was giving to Esau, that he was sort of trying to make restitution for what he'd done, because it makes me rethink what he was wrestling with the angel about. Earlier, a couple weeks ago, when you were talking about when Jacob and Rachel fooled, I'm getting my names mixed up, but anyway, when they put the fur on Jacob so that he looked like Esau,
yes.
I believe you said that you thought that the blessing that he was trying to get from Jacob was different from the inheritance that he had previously stole from Esau by trading it for soup. And if now what he's wrestling with, or what he's actually regretting what he did in fooling Esau, that would mean that he was regretting having tricked him out of his birthright, and also regretting having stolen the blessing. And if those two things are separate things, I'm still thinking about that, but I'm wondering if... I've often wondered, since it seems that God had blessed Jacob before he wrestled with the angel, I mean, he had all these flocks and family and all this kind of thing, what it was he wanted from God. If it's possible that he saw the birthright and the blessing to be related or the same thing, maybe he realized that no matter how he tricked Jacob, this blessing and this birthright were not mechanical things that you could trick someone out of. They were gods at God's discretion to give. So it didn't really matter whether Esau had said, okay, you can have my birthright. You can't get it that way. And it didn't really matter if he had tricked Esau or Jacob into blessing him, or Isaac into blessing him. That was God's to give. So at this point, he regretted having, not only regretted having tricked his brother, but he realized he hadn't gotten anything by doing it anyway. Therefore, he had to go to the one from whom the birthright came and from whom the blessing came. And I'm wondering if, I mean, he still wanted it, but he realized that he hadn't gotten it by his trickery. And so now that's what he's asking from God. The birthright comes from you. I understand now. I can't buy it for soup. The blessing comes from you. And so that's what I want from you. And when he comes to Esau, both brothers believe they have been blessed by God. So I wonder if Esau also came to the recognition that this is not, a blessing is not something can be stolen from me. If God's determined to bless me, he will bless me. And part of the blessing was the younger shall serve the older or whatever. I wonder if the significance of Jacob calling him my Lord and his family prostrating themselves in front of Esau is the recognition that we are prepared to serve you, because that was the original blessing which I attempted to steal from you, but I couldn't. It can't be stolen. So I'm just wondering, what do you think of all this?
That all sounds very, very plausible to me. You've taken it a little further than I had taken it, but all of that sounds very plausible to me. The wrestling match, I think, is, as I understand it, when it begins, Jacob is just wrestling with this random person. And it's only through the course of the wrestling match through the night that he comes to realize that he's not wrestling with some random person. He's wrestling with God himself. And I think that he's coming to the realization that through his life, he's been inclined to think that his wrestling match was with circumstances and with people, and it was just doing whatever it takes to get ahead. And what he came to realize in that wrestling match is the wrestling match is not with, it's not with Esau, it's not with getting the birthright and the blessing. The real match that counts is the wrestling match that I go through with God. And what he came to realize is in that wrestling match, what I need is God's blessing, whatever that is. And he was desperate for that blessing. He came to realize that's where real life comes from. And I want that no matter what. Even if I have to wrestle with a dislocated hip, that's what I want. And so the blessing then is God acknowledging that he has come to that point, and indeed blessing him as a result of that, of his persistence. Understanding, getting perspective on things, and then his persistence.
I wondered also whether Esau bringing men to guard Jacob was an indication that Esau recognized that the blessing could not be taken from him, because one of the responsibilities of someone who is served mm-hmm. is responsibility for that person, mm-hmm. For their well-being. And so Esau was actually saying, okay, you think you've stolen the blessing from me, but you haven't, and I have this responsibility toward you as a result of it, and I am going to fulfill that.
That could very well be, yeah. That's interesting. Thanks.
I have an announcement, not a question. For the past 9 weeks, I've had the pleasure and privilege of being part of a band of homeschool kids taught by Doug Hooley. And as part of the end of the class, we're going to be performing the songs we've prepared this Saturday, the 23rd, at 7 o'clock p.m. in the Puccinelli Art Gallery at the Study Center. Our songs include Be Our Guest from Beauty and the Beast and Bad Moon Rising, and lots of other songs that you'd probably recognize. It's perfectly free to come. We're not charging anything. And the kids involved are Rachel, Jared, and Megan Hooley, Dan Chase, Jackie Stoller, Noah Crabtree, Levi Sager, and me, Aaron Julian. And please don't feel obligated to come. I just want to let everybody know if they wanted to come, but you don't have to. And if you have any questions, ask Doug Hooley, I guess, or me. That's all.
Okay, thanks.